This is Changemakers with Katie Gore, finding the right solutions for the affordable housing community.
This week's changemaker is Deborah DeSantis, the President and Chief Executive Officer of the Corporation for Supportive Housing, or CSH, the country's largest community development financial institution devoted to housing solutions for those at risk of homelessness. On her watch, CSH has tripled its lending and support through the creation of more than 300,000 permanent stable homes for people struggling through the trauma of homelessness, lack of health care, and intergenerational poverty. Deb, welcome to the podcast.
It's my pleasure. So thank you for this opportunity, Katie.
Before we get started discussing the Corporation for Supportive Housing, let's get to know you and your journey into affordable housing. So take us back to how it all started for you.
Sure. It starts back in state government, actually, in the state of New Jersey, where I was working for then Governor Christy Todd Whitman. And I was in the Department of Community Affairs that oversees a number of different programs, but probably the biggest program is affordable housing. And I just got very interested in affordable housing issues. And at some point in her administration, I sought the opportunity to work at the Housing Finance Agency, which is the agency in state government that funds affordable housing, so single family and multifamily. And I did that for about 4 years. I was the executive director there. And it was at the agency that I actually came into contact with the Corporation for Supportive Housing, and also really grew an interest in what was then referred to as special needs housing.
You've been named one of the 10 most influential Americans for homelessness reform. You're the president and CEO for the Corporation of Supportive Housing. But first, tell us and our listeners, because we have a wide variety of listeners, just start real basic and tell us, what is supportive housing?
Great question. Very simply, supportive housing is affordable housing with services for those individuals and families who need the services connected to the housing to help them thrive in the housing and also in the community. So typically residents are individuals who are at risk of homelessness, who have experienced homelessness, or who have a history of institutional care. Most importantly, supportive housing residents have a lease, and the services are flexible, and so the housing is not contingent upon someone taking the services.
And so why are the services so important? I mean, not just quality of life, but what other, you know, maybe data or results have you seen when affordable housing is coupled with services?
Yeah, we see a number of things depending on the population, but I think across the board, what we see is that when someone is in supportive housing, their housing stability is very strong. So typically people in supportive housing stay in supportive housing, so that retention is really important. And then we see studies where if there are children in the family, we've seen where the children have better education outcomes because they're going to school. We see studies of supportive housing where individuals have better health outcomes. So, you know, across the board, it's really exciting to see that actually when you do pair the housing with services, people are faring better.
You know, and you've been there for, what, 14 years?
A little longer than that, because I started with CSH as the director of one of our state programs and then became president. But I've been president for about 14 years now.
And how have you seen supportive housing maybe change over this? You know, what's happened with either the level of services or just the delivery model? Has there been a change, or has it been pretty consistent this whole time?
You know, a number of things have changed, certainly for CSH. I think the most dramatic change is how we think about supportive housing, the intervention supportive housing. So very early on in our history, CSH was created primarily to help communities address chronic homelessness. So those individuals with a history of health issues, typically mental health issues or substance issues, living on the streets or in shelters for a prolonged time. There was this thought that if we could get them into housing and then connect them to the services, they'd be better off. And CSH was created to bring capital to communities around the country to help communities develop the housing, build provider capacity, and then do the advocacy work at the federal, state, and local level. And along our journey, what we realized was that the homeless system itself is a very small system. And when you look at the individuals and families that are cycling through that system, there's a larger story. It's not that one day they woke up and they became homeless. What we saw for those individuals who had those health issues and that long experience with homelessness, typically they had some other system involvement, like justice involvement or child welfare involvement. And so we started working with providers around the country to really understand how to engage those other systems so that we could educate them about the role of housing and services in not just ending someone's experience with homelessness, but preventing it. So I would say that was one of the biggest changes, was this realization that we needed to do the work to engage those larger systems. And then I think the other big sea change for us and the supportive housing field is to recognize the importance of not just building housing units, not just getting people housed. That's really important. But we want to make sure that when individuals and families get housed, that they have what they need to actually thrive, so that we're not warehousing individuals and families. Because that's not what we want. We don't want to just take credit for getting people housed. We want to understand what that trajectory looks like once they get housed. And if indeed, you know, longer term, do their health outcomes improve? Do they have access to employment? Do they have access to better education outcomes, et cetera?
You just laid out several ways of understanding how people get into a homeless situation. And you've brought up important pieces about engaging early on with services. It really brings me to another point. Tell us about this FUSE initiative.
Yeah, FUSE is a great initiative. And I want to share a little lore with you. It actually came out of a conversation many, many years ago in New York City, where the commissioner of the jail system in New York City was in an elevator with the commissioner of the homeless system. And there were witnesses, and they were having a conversation about people in their systems. And I'm somewhat embellishing, but the conversation went something like this. Your people are ending up in my system. Your people are ending up in my system. Mm-hmm. And so CSH used that as an opportunity to work with those two systems to look at how people actually were flowing between systems. And I hypothesized that if we could target the individuals who were, I call it ping-ponging between the systems most frequently, and use instead a supportive housing intervention, could we indeed reduce their experience with either of those systems or both of those systems? From that conversation came this idea that we now refer to as FUSE. In New York City, it started looking at those two systems, justice and homelessness. And we have now worked with a good number of communities to do very similar work, looking at different systems. Sometimes we're looking at the homeless system and the healthcare system. We just finished an initiative with Portland and Multnomah County in Oregon. We did a FUSE initiative there looking at a jail, homeless, and healthcare involved population to see if we could use supportive housing to reduce, again, their system involvement. And the results of that study initiative just came out. And indeed, it shows that, with supportive housing, there is a reduction in their usage of those systems. Jail stays, for instance, goes down when people are in housing and have access to services. And what this study then went on to say was, there was a population of a little over close to, I think, 1,800, and a portion of those actually got into supportive housing. But if all of the individuals got into supportive housing, it would have saved the county and city over $10 million. So, what we have seen time and time again when we study supportive housing and its efficacy in communities, we see cost savings and in many of those communities, and we see better outcomes for the individuals or families that get into housing with the services.
So you're saying that if chronically homeless individuals, in this particular study, either what avoided or ended their chronic homelessness with supportive housing, $10 million in savings would be realized? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, because what happens, Katie, is those individuals that I referenced in that elevator conversation, right? So they're not going into jail one day out of the year. What we see are those individuals going into jail multiple a number of days throughout the year, and then going over into the homeless system, and then perhaps needing emergency room care. And so when you look at the cost of those different systems over a year, and you add that up, and you compare that to the cost of someone being in housing with services, there's most definitely a difference in the cost. It's costlier to have people cycling between systems than it is to have them in housing, thriving with services.
So those savings would have been realized in either avoided jail or ER or Medicaid savings. That's how those costs would be avoided then?
Absolutely right. That's right.
So, one of the questions I have is, how did the name Fuse? Like, where did that come from? What's the story there?
Let me just be perfectly honest and say one thing we don't do really well at CSH is come up with catchy names for our initiatives. But FUSE stood for Frequent User Service Enhancement. So it was that individual who's using the systems frequently, the frequent user, and the idea was that if we could provide the services with housing, that we could avoid that ping-ponging effect.
Well, that's still catchy. It gives us a background of what it is.
I guess.
I thought maybe you were going to tell me that you were going to light the fuse on,
I'm sure that was a little bit of it, but no.
I want to ask you something. You mentioned that CSH is also in the development and building space, and you guys are a lender that focuses on affordable supportive housing. So what kind of lending services do you offer that allow you to invest in communities across the nation?
We actually do a number of things as a national intermediary organization. We provide technical assistance to government and providers and developers to develop their capacity around supportive housing. And we do a lot of advocacy work with the federal government, state, and local governments. But we also are, as you note, a lender investor. So we are a community development financial institution, and that means that we receive resources from the federal treasury to invest in disenfranchised communities. And part of that is providing pre-development and acquisition funding to developers, and developers being nonprofit or for-profit developers that are committed to creating supportive housing. And typically, projects have affordable units and supportive housing mixed in, and the developers are committed to serving a target population, so a population that's eligible for supportive housing. And as a lender, I like to say that we have a higher risk tolerance for working with developers and in communities and on projects that perhaps some other investors would look at and maybe shy away from. But because we have this long history of doing the program work and doing the advocacy work and working with our government partners, we kind of understand what the issues are and how to mitigate the issues and bring the project to fruition. And then we're also a New Market Tax Credit investor. The reason for that, Katie, is that years ago, when we looked at our portfolio of projects, what we acknowledged was the importance of ensuring access to quality health care for residents of supportive housing. And so we saw the New Market Tax Credit program as a vehicle to do that. So we have sought allocations from the federal government for a number of years now and have been very fortunate to get those allocations. And we have invested in projects around the country that have some relationship to affordable and supportive housing so that we can provide that access to quality healthcare for residents. And then lastly, I'll just mention that we've also invested in pay for success deals around the country. And these are initiatives that really make the assumption that in the deals that we have invested in that focus primarily on supportive housing as an intervention, the assumption is that if we can provide supportive housing to individuals, then there's going to be some sort of cost offset to how they were being served up until that point, and there will be better outcomes. So we've invested in projects that have housed in Massachusetts. We're very proud to have been an investor there, where more than 800 individuals experiencing chronic homelessness were housed in supportive housing, achieved better outcomes, and proved to government that, you know, this is indeed an effective intervention that can be replicated.
I see why you are the nation's largest community development financial institution for, you know, being devoted to those individuals who are at risk of homelessness, because that's a wide variety of financing. I mean, congratulations on the New Market Tax Credits. Those are incredibly competitive. And so for you guys to be able to blend all this together, it is really a testimony of how comprehensive you guys are at leveraging funds, being a lender, being a provider, and being committed to not just the human side of this, but providing more affordable housing, because that's a piece that everybody is trying to achieve as well. You know, maintaining what we have, preserving what's there, and then building more. I'm sure that was a visionary moment for CSH.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think for us, you know, there's always this question of, in a community, do you lead with your lending or do you follow with your lending? Mm-hmm. And because we do things beyond our lending, it helps us really understand the market from different lenses. And so there are communities where there isn't local capacity to do supportive housing, and there isn't a pipeline of supportive housing projects, and we haven't been there doing the advocacy work. And we look at those communities and we say, you know what, maybe if we were at the table with our government partners, that we could demonstrate how to create that pipeline. And so then we lead with our lending and then come behind that with our advocacy work and our capacity building work. And then other times it's we're going in and doing that advocacy work to create that environment that's ready for creating a supportive housing pipeline. So we try to be very strategic about how we use our role as a lender investor.
You know, so if you were talking with some developers, I mean, what would be some of those things that you would say at the table? And, you know, how would you go about trying to give them a glimpse of what you guys know in the day-to-day space with preventing homelessness? How would you start that conversation?
Well, one, I would encourage them to participate in what we refer to as our Supportive Housing Institute. If we were hosting an institute in their state, so we've worked with government partners to host an institute that looks a little different depending on the community and the local partners, but typically it's run over several months, and we invite developers to come to the table with their service provider partner and their property manager and anybody on the development team. We've had teams come with their architects. And it's really geared towards building their capacity as a developer to understand the nuts and bolts of supportive housing. So to understand, you know, when you're designing supportive housing, there's some design considerations for the population you're serving. When you are thinking about the services, depending on the population you're serving, you're going to be using different service funding sources, and you have different service program considerations. And then one of the things we do is like connect the developers to the permanent financing at the end of some of our institutes. So it's a fairly intensive process, but what's exciting about it, and we just completed one in Oregon, actually, state of Oregon. And what's exciting is that then these developers come out of it understanding supportive housing and having the ability to really focus on, okay, not this one project, that one-off project, but, you know, what's the pipeline going to look like going forward? But I think, you know, typically when we're working with developers who've never done supportive housing, but for some reason they're motivated now, it's really about building their education, demystifying supportive housing, and making sure that they're doing the things as a good neighbor at the beginning of the process. So working with communities to educate the communities about supportive housing and the tenant population, and try to abate the NIMBY issues early on.
You have been working in affordable housing, and I'm sure that you've seen that stigma or that NIMBYism that mm-hmm. you just mentioned, and especially when it comes to the most vulnerable populations. I mean, are there like a couple of things that always work for CSH when you guys try to battle those preconceived notions, or do you just have to kind of flex it for every situation, every community?
Great question. I think that last point I just made is really important. So, and I think honestly, developers make this mistake not just in supportive housing, but in not understanding the importance of being a good neighbor and going out and knocking on doors and introducing yourself to the community before shovel hits the ground. So I think where we have seen supportive housing developers be really successful, it is when they have done that upfront work, when they've made that investment in community education. I think also where we have seen owners, operators of supportive housing be really successful is when they design their buildings in a way that they will be accommodating to the larger community. So offering space or offering programming that will be available to the larger community. It might be a Head Start program. It might be, you know, there's a wonderful development in New York that has community space that they use for local art shows. So residents in the neighborhood who want to display their artwork, and they do a lot of community program. There's an interesting study that the Furman Center in New York did a good number of years ago, but it was to look at this issue of when supportive housing is developed, Is there a negative impact on property values in the larger neighborhood? And they actually studied the five boroughs of New York. I think it was about 123 developments throughout the five boroughs. And what they actually found was that there was essentially no negative impact of supportive housing in a neighborhood on the property values, that indeed within that immediate area, what they saw was a slight uptick in property values. So I think, if supportive housing is done right, if the services are in place, there's nothing for neighbors to fear. I think it's really an opportunity to embrace the residents and add to the diversity of the neighborhood.
You know, speaking of adding to diversity and, just kind of expanding our reach here, not just in affordable housing, but CSH, you guys have actually posted a senior project manager job. And it was interesting that you guys had a statement in there about having the project manager be committed to racial equity and advancing anti-racism practices. Hopefully something we'll start seeing in a lot of job descriptions, but what is that doing for you as an organization? Or, is that something that's in all your postings now?
Yeah, thank you for that question. Yes, it is in all of our job postings. This is part of our commitment to becoming an anti-racist organization. We recognize that this is not a static effort, that this is a work that our organization will be doing for the long while. And it's really to acknowledge structural racism throughout the country and its impact on people of color. And we're committed to doing the work internally and then also provide tools and resources to our partners and the communities that we work to also help them along on their own journey. We've created a race equity impact assessment tool that we've just started to run all of our programs and initiatives through, to make sure that we are doing no harm to Black, Indigenous, people of color communities. And we've also created a tool. It's the RDDI tool, Race Disproportionality and Disparity Index. I told you we're not real sexy when we come up with these names, but it's a tool that we created to help communities look at and do the analysis around the disproportional impact of people of color within those crisis systems. So who's in the jail? Who's in the child welfare system? Who's in the homeless system? And to really lift up the fact that there is a disproportionate number of people of color in those systems. So as we do the work, ultimately, what we want to make sure is that as we use supportive housing as an intervention, that at the end of the day, we haven't done it in a way so that only white people are getting into supportive housing, that we're addressing the disproportionality and the disparities, and then seeing those changes within those larger systems.
Well, Deb, I'm going to help you out with your acronym, the RDDI. I'm going to say that it actually sounds like ready. Like, so you guys are ready to tackle this.
Yeah, I like that. Thank you. I think from now on, we're going to consult with you ahead of time.
Right. Well, if people are studying the impacts to housing, whether it's, home ownership rates, whether it's the ability to get mortgages, whether it's eviction rates or people access to supportive housing or access to supports. I mean, the statistics are out there. So, it is data that's readily available, but organizations like yours who are taking a look at it, breaking it apart, tackling it, and trying to say not just awareness, but how do we move through solution making? And, it sounds like you guys are organizationally really making a great best foot forward to address some of this. And it's going to take multiple layers of multiple organizations. So kudos to you guys for just taking a step forward here.
No, thank you for that, Katie. And, you know, I said it before, I'll say it again. It is a journey to think that you can do things, say that you're going to become an anti-racist organization and just check the boxes. That's not going to work. So we're committed to the work that we need to lead over time. And it's hard, but it's to see the results is really very gratifying.
Well, thank you for your time with us today, Deb. You and your team, you guys have been a great inclusion here into the discussion we've been having on affordable housing. So it was a good forum for us to hear about what CSH is doing.
Well, thank you. Thank you for including supportive housing. I should have mentioned that CSH is now 30 years old and we'll be celebrating that milestone at the end of this year. But we really are so thankful for everyone that we have worked with along the way because they have made us smarter and stronger and better. We look forward to tackling these issues with our partners going forward. So thank you again for this opportunity.
Thanks for listening to Changemakers with Katie Gore. To find out more about Katie, go to quadel.com. That's QUADEL.com. This has been a production of Forbes Books Radio.